Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
This was a moving podcast with Chris Hansen as he opens up about his journey of losing his mom at a young age, being adopted by his stepdad, his adventures in Alaska where he trained and ran a dog sled team, and so much more. We discuss his movie, The Day I Disremembered, and how this medical episode led him to the sport he loves, fly fishing. Chris is a talented fly fisher and has a wonderful social media presence. He is an ambassador with Douglas Fly Rods and Cortland Lines. We close talking about another one of his loves, bourbon, and his custom blend. Stay tuned. The Fly Fishing Show Tour travels the country every winter. From January until March, the largest consumer fly fishing shows in the world will be in one of six locations. The regular stops are Marlboro, Mass., which covers the New England area, Edison, New Jersey, which is the New York, New Jersey, Mid-Atlantic States show, Atlanta, Georgia, Denver, Colorado, Pleasanton, California, the Bay Area show, and finally back to where it all started in Pennsylvania at the Lancaster show. These shows are super fun events that are packed with teaching, presentations, and everything you could ever want to know or see in fly fishing. Find all the details at flyfishingshow.com. Chris, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, no, we're excited to talk to you here because you're both this brand ambassador for Cortland and Douglas, as we've talked about. You actually have this fly fishing story, the story of your life that has come out on YouTube, and it's called The Day I Disremembered. Just a really fascinating story about this episode that happened in your life that actually brought you into the sport of fly fishing. Why don't you tell our listeners just a bit overview, because I do want to dive in a little deeper on it, but just an overview of the movie.
We were on vacation, and, you know, I work a lot, you know, work long hours, you know, and we were on vacation, and we were going to head home, and I woke up, and we were packing up, and all of a sudden, I was started asking my wife odd questions, you know, like, why didn't we spend time out on the balcony? And she said, we have. We've had breakfast out there, dinner, and I said, I don't want to scare you, but I don't remember that. So she thought I was having a stroke. And rushed me to the hospital. Talking about it years later, it's a bizarre experience. So it kind of hits me every time I start talking about it. But it was really like stress, people that have migraines. We went to the hospital after doing a bunch of tests. They determined that, okay, it's not a stroke. It's process of elimination. And then they go, this was transient global amnesia. It affects a small percentage of people. If you have migraines, it's kind of a common thread. If you have, you know, a lot of stress in your life, and there's just something that can trigger it. And what happens is during the episode, you cannot create new memories. So in the moment, in that 5 minutes, you know everything. And then when that 5 minutes is gone, you're literally confused and going, what are we doing here? Why are we in the hospital? Where's my wallet? I'm asking my wife the same questions over and over.
Wow. I had never heard of this diagnosis before, this amnesia.
Yeah. Yeah, most people don't. It affects a small percent of people. And when you get it, the likelihood you'll get it again is very low, but actually people have gotten it a second time.
Interesting. So you're at the hospital there. They're running some tests. They tell your wife they think it's a
transient global amnesia.
Transient global amnesia. And what happened like that? What is this process of that day? What is she dealing with? Like, where do you, and how did, what was the result?
Scary for her.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, me during this 8-hour episode, I'm only in 5 minutes. Every 5 minutes, I'm in reality.
That's crazy.
So for her, you know, she's like, you know, rushes me to the hospital because she thinks it's a stroke. And then when they're doing testing, you know, it's really about doing the tests and going, okay, it's not a stroke. So then she's like, oh, thank goodness. And then, okay, it's not this. And, and you know, doing all these scans and different things. And then they started saying, okay, because we got this out of the way, we're very confident it's transient global amnesia. So at this point, this is probably going to last a few hours. He's going to ask you questions over and over because he can't form new memories. But eventually, he'll get out of it, and then he'll be able to form new memories.
Tell us a little bit about how this resolved itself.
At one point, I was really asking kind of the same questions over and over to Bobby Joe, to my wife. And then at one point, I ask, I remember it, and then all of a sudden, it's back to normal.
You started remembering again.
Yeah. Like, you know, so at that point, that it was kind of funny because I remember this part, obviously. The doctor comes in with six or seven other, you know, like doctors, younger, and they started, do you remember me? Asking me questions. They all had their notepads and they're writing down, and it was fascinating to them. Like, this is a real case of transient global amnesia that we treated in our hospital. And so he really said, you have to figure out how to manage your stress. You can't keep going nonstop. You can't, you know, we were on vacation, but, you know, it's rare. And even I'm the type of guy on vacation, you know, if we're out to dinner, you know, I'm the rude guy that gets an email and I'm like, sorry, gets a phone call, sorry.
You're just taking it.
And I'm just, that's me. And it's kind of how I am with everything. I'm all in. And he said, you can't do it. You have migraines, doesn't help with that. And you're going to have to figure out a way to relax and to slow down.
Is this a brain injury or how, like, what?
Yeah, so because migraines are a common thread with people that get it, it is a form of migraine, you could say, because, yes, it does affect
that. It's like an intense migraine.
Yeah.
And you get migraines.
I do, yeah.
Yeah. I've never had a migraine, but I guess what I've had would be some, like, a mild migraine where it's just like kind of shuts you down a little bit. But I've seen some people, they just have to go lay down and everything kind of gets black and it's just painful.
That's the way mine are. Fortunately, I can go quite a ways without getting them. But when I get them, it's, you know, typically waking up at 2 a.m. trying to fight it off, can't. And then I get nauseous. So like it's throwing up, like, because the pain is so intense. And so it's from there to like 5 o'clock.
Usually, in the middle of the night?
Usually it starts in the middle. Sometimes before I go to bed, I feel like, one coming on and I try to fend it off, so to speak. And it usually hits me bad in the morning, 1, 2, 3 in the morning.
Well, let's take you back to the beginning. Early parts of your life, you are from
Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was born in Minneapolis, so a city kid. Interesting, which I talk in the film about some of these details. I'm adopted, you know, some different things happen in my life early on that, watch the film.
Is it okay to share? Because I know you had mentioned, early on in your life, you were about 8 years old, your mom passed.
Yes, yeah. We lived in a not so great neighborhood in South Minneapolis.
Yeah.
She was shot, so she was killed. And
yeah, I saw that. Yeah. Sorry, that's rough.
Yeah, and so it's funny because when I think about everything in the past, I go, well, you know, could you change something? I really wouldn't change anything except for I wish I knew her.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I had a relationship with her. But beyond that, I think the things that happen to us are really what makes us who we are.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be bad qualities,
right,
which I have a few of those, and it can be a lot of great qualities.
Yeah.
So at that point, my biological father, he was already out of the picture. My stepdad, he moved us out of that area, and eventually he remarried, adopted me, and then my older sister, you know, she didn't fare too well. She didn't want to kind of go on with that, you know, life, be adopted,
family,
ran away, kind of tried to find our, you know, biological family, and she's had a tough life.
Yeah. So it was your adopted parents turned out to be your stepdad.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't pick that up.
Yeah, so many things, to cram in.
Yeah, so long, yeah.
Yeah.
So much stuff to put in there.
Yeah, so he was our legal guardian. He was, you know,
that's
at that point.
Super happy moment, though.
Yeah.
That's a super joyful part of an extremely difficult situation.
Yeah.
So losing your mom at 8 years old, there are parts of your life that kind of just change forever because of that.
Yeah, which, you know, you probably can tell, you know, talking about it. I mean, it's, you know, 51 years old. But, you know, I wear my emotions on my sleeve. I mean, it's just always the way I've been. But, yes, it does. It really didn't. When I was, like, 20 and I had moved to Alaska is when all of that kind of really, like, I don't know, it was a weird thing to describe, but, you know, came crashing down on me.
Yeah.
Like, realizing, you know, my mom and all these, you know, things. Up until that, I was just kind of going with the flow. I mean, it really wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't think it affected
my. Didn't hit you to the core because it's probably so traumatic that you don't want it to hit you to the core.
Yeah. You know, when you're young and, you know, I mean, you just, you know, you're going on with life and
day to day.
Yeah. Day to day and stuff.
Let's jump into Alaska, because I know at that point you said you were about 20, and I know I've seen some of these pictures from the movie. You've got that kind of youthful ambition with the sled dogs. And tell our listeners a bit about your time in Alaska. You're 20 years old. How long did you spend there, and what was it like?
So backing up before that, I didn't go to high school. So I don't call myself a high school dropout, because I never went. Got into sled dogs. And I relate that experience to fly fishing. The first time I went out riding in a sled, I heard about this woman who had sled dogs. Hey, can I come over and see the dogs? Well, you can, but I'm taking them out on a run if you want to go with. And I'm like, yes. So I show up. There's 100 dogs. I mean, she had a ton of sled dogs. Hooks up a team. They love running. They're jumping up and down. It's chaos. And my first introduction was hopping in a sled and going on a 30-mile run. 3 hours.
That was your first introduction.
That was my first introduction. I had no money. And on that, the whole time, I'm going, I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I have no money to buy dogs, feed them, but I'm going to do this.
Did you get through the course or the race or the...
So it was just a training run, I'm just riding in the sled.
Oh, okay. You were just along for the ride.
I'm just thinking, I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And so that started my passion of sled dogs, which was like 12 years. And then from there, moving to Alaska and training a team for Iditarod. I didn't run it, but trained a team with a guy up there. Came back to Minnesota and started racing on my own. Was quite successful, winning some races.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I kind of breathed and lived sled dogs for 12 years.
What's that like? I mean, it's probably a lot of work to take care of those dogs.
It's a lot of work. You have, you know, several different dogs, different personalities. The best comparison is they're like a lab, where they're fetching a stick is in them. You know, you can throw a stick and a lab will get it. But training them to get it, bring it back, sit, drop it, to hold another thing. Sled dogs love to pull. That's what they're, you know, they're born to do. And so training them and training them voice commands, you know, it's fascinating. It's a lot of fun. Competition, you know, racing is a lot of fun as well. A lot of strategy involved.
Before we jump back into the podcast, here's a short word from one of our fantastic sponsors. Are you a guide, a lodge, or a product manufacturer in the fly fishing or outdoor industry? I want to introduce you to and highlight Cross Current Insurance. Their entire team are great people and experts in their field. They have a guide insurance program that is amazing and very affordable. If you are a lodge or retailer, they also have programs tailored to your needs. These guys fish and are in the outdoors, so they know the industry and the landscape. To get more information on a program that's perfect for you, find them at crosscurrentinsurance.com.
Are there different breeds of sled dogs, or is it pretty much all one style of breed that's a sled dog?
Yeah, great questions. For many years, you know, sled dogs are referred to as Alaskan Huskies, but they're really a specialized mutt. You know, over the years from like gold mining and, you know, where work dogs were highly valued, they bred dogs according to the traits they wanted in them for working, Malamute. And then as, you know, like racing, you know, like, okay, we could breed greyhound in them, you know, deep chest, you know, fast runners, but not good coats. And so they bred these things into them. And what you have now when you look at it is you go, oh, that's a husky.
Yeah.
But they can look very different.
Interesting. Where did you live in Alaska?
I lived very remote, south of Nome. And so even when you talk to Alaskans, you know, oh, I used to live up here. Where'd you live? St. Michael, south of Nome. What the heck? What were you doing? Like, you know, it's still, it's extreme for them. So most people know Nome.
From the shows, right? What is that?
It's the finish of the Iditarod, for one.
Okay.
And then south of Nome, there's an inlet, and it's on the coast. So I lived on St. Michael. So I lived a small Eskimo village. Only way to get there, boat or plane.
Wow. Snowmobiles. Fun stuff.
Yeah.
Really
on the tundra. I experienced cabin fever. Yeah, which was crazy.
Wow.
Because of the, you know, limited daylight, you know, 3-4
yeah.
hours. And single. And so, you know, get up, feed the dogs, go back and away from family, friends. And,
yeah.
And it's weird how...
Well, you talked in your movie that, you know, you couldn't afford, like, these high-end dogs that were, like, just go, go, go.
Yeah.
Like, bred for, like, high-speed racing and really bred for that. But you kind of took on some cast-offs or some problem dogs, and you kind of built a team of dogs that maybe others discarded.
I did, yeah. I brought back some good dogs from Alaska, but prior to that, it's exactly what I did. I couldn't afford dogs, so I would get problem dogs, you know, like somebody that, you know, they have a great race team, and they're like, you know, this dog, it's like, you know, it's super shy, it's this, it's that, it doesn't, you know, I just like, you know, you can have it. Or $50 and you can have it. And so that's how I put together my team, was really from a bunch of rejects from other dog mushers. And the first race I ran, I came in second. And some of the people I got dogs from, I had beat in the race. So it was pretty awesome.
Please excuse the forwardness of this question, because I think what I was getting from that particular moment, when you build a team from dogs that maybe were discarded or had issues or maybe were having challenges, and you were their, you know, their lead, it seemed like you kind of, your personality was coming out in your team, or you were relating to your dog through some difficulties you had in your own life.
Yeah, no, that's definitely perceptive. It's as you put together these teams and they have these, you know, problems, and just learning to work through them and giving them, you know, that extra time and attention and, you know, really caring for them.
It's, yeah.
Was a fun part that then as you get better dogs, that's just a part of the mentality of doing of that, spending time, quality training, and really treating each one as an individual, even though you have a kennel of dogs and
yeah.
a team, and really paid off as I, you know, got more and more into it.
And I think, you know, we hear about this term mental health so much more today. I mean, turn on the TV, listen to the radio, turn on a podcast, listen to, you know, news. You can't escape this terminology coming out of this pandemic and people isolating for so long or early on and during COVID. And especially with kids mask mandates in school and stuff. And you hear about mental health and checking in on people, how are you doing? And we never saw that. We never heard
right.
that. I mean, that wasn't terminology like 5
yep.
years ago or before. You know, maybe you'd have people who were, you know, dealing with different things in their life and they'd have to go through that. But as far as like a society, we never
right.
heard so much focus on checking in on people because of mental health concerns.
Yep. When I ran sled dogs, there was something that I got from that that was lost later when I was working, which is a lot of times you go on a night run. So it's a full moon, hook up a team, and you're out there for 3 hours, 4 hours, and it's silent. You don't hear anything except the dogs panting, the runners on the, you know, cold snow crunching, and you're just gliding through the woods. And it was definitely a time where I could think about things I didn't have time to think about. I could not think about anything, and it was very relaxing. And then when I wasn't doing that, you know, just the drive of, you know, everything else that you're trying to do, make enough money to support the dogs, to get to races. And later when I, you know, got into the digital field, the same passion towards that and working, but I didn't have that outlet of sled dogs, of hooking mm-hmm. a team up and being gone for 3 or 4 hours.
So what moved you from Alaska to, as you go right to Colorado, or how did you?
To Minnesota.
You went back to Minnesota?
Yep.
After Alaska.
To keep training dogs. At that okay. point, I'm still working for somebody, so there was a job available in Minnesota.
Okay.
He wanted me to help him train an Iditarod team since I had just done it.
Yep.
So I went and worked with him, trained a team for him. And then at that point, actually, I decided to go to college. So
oh.
I, yeah.
Picked up college. You skipped the middle part.
Yeah. I recommend it. No, not really.
Now, do you have to provide some type of GED to get into this college or something?
I did, yeah. So I took my GED. I read a lot.
Okay.
I read a lot. So I did well. I did really good, actually.
Yeah.
But math, you know, I'm not good with math. And,
yeah.
And it hurt. It hurt me with math, but everything else wasn't a problem.
Okay. Were you fishing at all up in Minnesota and or Alaska?
I did. I fished. I went through stages of, you know, fishing, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, let's say we go on vacation with my wife's sister and her husband. He'd fish every day if we're camping. I'd fish 2 or 3 days with him.
Yeah.
I liked it, but not that much.
Yeah, yeah.
So I grew up, you know, fishing, just not fly fishing. But fly fishing, you know, hit me a totally different way.
Yeah. And then so you had this amnesia, this episode with amnesia. And if I understand the movie correctly, you kind of fell into fly fishing after that.
So, yeah. So what happened is we came back and, you know, I agreed with Bobby Joe and the doctor. And I'm like, yes, I need, you know, something to relax with. I can't keep working. But I fell into, you know, my status quo. And you know, Bobby Joe's, you know, she's like, you know, you can't, you know, keep doing this and working like this. And we had talked about fly fishing. It had just come up like curiosity.
Yeah.
But she booked a trip for my birthday.
To try to relax you.
Yeah.
So, get you to slow down.
Exactly. So that's how it started, is I went on a guided trip. And that's why I say it reminds me of sled dogs, because that first day fly fishing, I said, I'm going to do this.
And you were living in Colorado at the
Colorado,
time?
Colorado, yes. Yeah.
And so what moved you from Minnesota to Colorado?
We went from, so I got into digital, selling cars at a dealership, but really the digital part of it later on. And then I got recruited to go to Texas to be over a dealer group, several dealerships out there for the digital part of it. And then Subaru recruited me. I was a digital strategist for Subaru.
Yep.
And then there was an opportunity to relocate to Colorado. And I wanted to get out of Texas. So we took it, came here, and then it was just, you know, not too long after that, I started my company in 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you, I understand you were late for your guide.
Yes.
For your guide day, because you were still busy at work.
I mean, get up and I'm, you know, like, oh, I, you know, do this, reply to this email, you know. Mm-hmm. And
who did you fish with?
I fish with Angler's Covey, and it's like a sad story. So Earl, he took me out on my first fly fishing day. Later, fast forward, our oldest son, you know, I said, hey, Earl, can you, you know, take us both out? And then, you know, a few years later, my one, our youngest is a lot younger than Gabe, and said, hey, you know, Earl, can we, you know, go on a trip? And Earl really struggled with alcoholism and, I think, service, you know, being in the Army, I'm not sure.
Okay.
And I got a call the day before our trip, and the Covey said, we got to reschedule with a different guide. Earl's no longer with us. And I'm like, I don't understand. What do you mean? Where did he go? No, he's not with us. Okay, yeah. You know, like, I don't understand. He committed suicide.
Wow.
And so they said, "Who, you know, who can you go? Who can you schedule with? Who can we schedule with?" And I said, "It wouldn't be the same. I'll just take Grandma." So I took Grandma out and fly fishing, and yeah. So Earl, that first day, he's a great guide. I caught some fish, and the one thing that stuck with—well, I mean, lots of things. Like through the whole day, I'm like, "I'm gonna fish." You know,
yeah.
I mean, I love this. I'm not gonna be a guide, but I'm gonna fly fish. And so at one point, I have like a really nice rainbow on, like it's pretty big fish. And, you know, it schools me. I mean, it takes off and then it's like gone and I lose it. And I was like, oh man, what did I do wrong? And he's like, it's your first time. You didn't do anything wrong. There's a lot of people that come out their first time and they catch a fish like that.
Yeah.
It's all luck. He said, if you want to consistently catch fish like that, you have to spend time on the water.
Yeah.
And so, I took that to heart. I mean, after that day, I think it was that day or the next day, I got a rod, reel.
Just got all set up. I'm ready to go.
Like, yeah,
diving
right,
in.
Like right away, you know, and then spent time on the water.
Yeah.
You know, going out there, trial error, learned a ton from different, you know, people. The Covey's a great shop, and I've become friends with, you know, the owners and John and these different people. And, you know, because a lot of people think I've fly fished my whole life, and I haven't, but I've I've learned so much. I mean, everything of any success you could say, it's because I've learned from other people and,
yeah.
you know, struck up a friendship with Pat Dorsey and, you know, I've learned from them.
Yep. And so from that point, you know, you started diving in and started fly fishing a lot and all throughout Colorado. Like, so tell me about some of the fishing around here in Colorado.
Yeah, because of where I'm located and work, I mostly fish the South Platte. There's several sections of Cheeseman Canyon, 11 Mile Canyon. Most people know my spot as 11 Mile Canyon because I fish there in the winter as well, and it's cold specifically there because the sun doesn't hit the spot. Deckers, you know, I'll fish that. The Dream Stream is where I learned and where I spent a lot of time fishing as well, and all of that's on the South Platte.
Yep.
And it all stays open. There's a couple different dams, and so they stay open in, you know, true tailwaters.
What do you like most about the South Platte?
I would say the I actually love the I love the technical part of it. Most people that fish it, it's very pressured, so fishing with small flies, you know, 22s, 24s, midges, 6X tippet, you know, like I really, and that's probably the analytical digital part of me, I really love the details and I love the technical part and I love that it's more challenging and I love the variety of all those places I mentioned.
Yeah.
Could take you to each one and each one is like you wouldn't know it's the same.
Yeah.
Like, this is the same river. Yes. They're vastly different. And different fish, you know, rainbows, browns, of course, cut bows, and then Snake River cutthroat, which are beautiful fish. And you can get, you know, some sizable fish as well.
We're going to take a short commercial break to hear from Tim O'Neill of Norvice.
What makes the Norvice different than another system?
There are a lot of rotary fly tying vices out there. The Norvice is the only vice that will truly spin when you tie flies, and there's a big difference between rotating a vice slowly and spinning it at a bit of a faster RPM. And being able to spin the hook on a zero axis rotations opens up a lot of doors for us in the world of fly tying.
Tell me about the introduction of colors to the Norvice system.
When we obtained the company from Norm, he said to me just a very, very short statement. He said, you know, I always thought a colored Norvice would be a cool item. We brought out five colors, Radical Red, Sunset Orange, Shamrock Green, Liberty Blue, and Royal Purple. We have five colors along with the black that you're accustomed to seeing with Norvice, and we've been doing very well with those.
To find more information and their online store, visit nor-vice.com.
Now, do you, in the winter when you need to go with these super small midges and stuff, are you just unweighted contact nymphing or using some weight or using a strike indicator?
Yeah.
What's your methods that you find successful?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a strike indicator guy, so I use yarn a lot because these fish with those small midges, if you ever watch a video, it's mind-blowing on how fast they can...
Spit it out.
Yeah.
It's crazy. In and out, right?
Like you fish with somebody and they'll go, you just lost one. No, no, I didn't.
Don't fish with that person anymore. Say you are no longer my fishing buddy.
Yeah.
I delete you from being my fishing buddy. You're canceled.
John, who I mentioned, who's a guide, had a sticker, a bumper sticker made, and it's set, never mind.
He's gone. Never mind. I love that.
Yeah.
That is actually awesome.
Yeah. So,
especially with the small stuff. Spit it out.
So I use the yarn because it's such soft takes.
New Zealand?
It's actually like the Pat Dorsey one.
Oh,
and so
okay.
It's
yeah, I've heard of this. Yeah.
So I use his. Just kind of gives you that. Especially in the wintertime. I mean, they're just so subtle.
Yeah.
So a little weight. Yeah, weight when you need, you know, weight.
With the yarn.
Three flies, yarn.
Three. No, you're one of these three fly guys. Two flies.
Yeah.
I can stop at two. I have a hard enough time keeping two flies straight. Never mind, three flies straight. Do you do pretty well of keeping everything, or are you like retying because you got to, you know,
no,
in your back, you know, hit something or you bump something or.
No, so. The only time I use two is when I'm really targeting larger fish, and that's because three flies, it's one more fly that can get, when you're fighting the fish,
yeah,
where they can get hooked on that third fly, and all
sure.
of a sudden it can, so I'll do two, but, you know, that's like really going after some bigger fish.
So usually it's one or usually it's three?
I do two for those, otherwise I'm regular fishing with three.
Three flies.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and I do 5X, 5X, and 6X to the last one. is my typical setup.
Do you do to the eye or do you do to the barb, to the bend?
Yeah, to the bend.
You do to the bend?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so I've kind of stopped using the bend because I hear like that fish when he goes to eat it can unset himself or not. He allow himself not to get hooked because he's hitting the line.
It's funny because I don't want to – the type of fly during hatches is – yes, it's important. I get it. But when I have people ask me, placement is everything. Like, in other words, there's
where
a lot
of
times
you're
sight fishing a fish and you're fishing and are you watching your indicator? Are you watching where your flies land? And are they drifting by? And most of the time, especially in winter, small midges, they're not going to zigzag back and forth to grab a little bug. They're going to open their mouth.
Yeah.
And so it can be like passing them to the side.
They don't care.
It's too much energy to go get that.
Too much food coming at them that they don't have to worry about it.
Right. So placement.
Technical. We're back on the technical thing.
Yeah. And so flies matter, but for most people that struggle with it, it's placement, you know.
Can you do okay with two?
Yeah.
Why do you love the third fly so much?
Why not?
Well, I can come up with a bunch of reasons, like tying on, tangling.
I have a method, too, of the three, you know.
Do you not, obviously, there's not a lot of backcasting going on here. It's basically just tight lining and backcast?
Yeah, you can. You know, I mean, once you get used to the setup, it's... I struggled with it, you know, in the beginning, but now it's, you know, when you get a tangle, you know, then you wish you didn't have three flies on, but for the most part, it's pretty easy. You can roll cast with it. You can back cast as well.
Cool.
But yeah.
Tell our listeners, now you are a brand ambassador for both Douglas Rods and Cortland Lines. How did your relationship with these companies come about?
You know, really when I started, I mean, you know, a lot of people talk negative about social media, but we're all on it. For me, you know, catching a fish and they're beautiful and they're all different patterns. And I took photos of them and I had an Instagram account I never used. And I'm like, this is like the perfect thing. And so I started posting some photos.
Okay.
And I wasn't catching big fish, but I loved the photos and I loved kind of capturing the background. And I think it was Cortland first and then it was Douglas. And I'm passionate about fly fishing. I'm, you know, very open and helpful to people asking, even though I'm, you know, learning along the way. An opportunity came up with Cortland. They were looking for somebody and I threw my name in the hat, had a phone call, and Douglas, I actually called them, heard about the rods, loved the rods, and talked to them. And so things just kind of progressed with both of them.
So I have to ask you, because, you know, kind of being out pictures and being out in the social media world or fishing in different parts of the world, you want to come up with great shots. And I think you kind of have some classic imagery that, you know, when you see your shots that you can tell that it's, you know, Chris Hansen shot. A lot of time are you by yourself with somebody? Are you able to capture this imagery fishing by yourself? Or do you have somebody helping you with the camera work? Or do you set up a tripod? Like, tell me a little bit about how you capture some of this imagery.
Fly fishing, to me, first, I'm a extreme introvert extrovert. So fly fishing many times is going by myself. And I have a lot of people that hit me up that want to go or people I fish with. But there's times where, and they know this, where, you know, I'm just going to fish by myself. And so I have a process by myself.
Oh, see, you see what he just did there, Joe? Bobby Joe, did you see what he just did there? I have a process. That's slang. That's insider terminology for I ain't telling you nothing.
No, so it's super, you know, the biggest thing with all of this is keep the trout in the net.
And okay.
It's easy to have stuff at your fingertips. I use a little tripod. My phone is in it. I keep the fish in the water the whole time.
Okay.
I take the tripod. I set it up. I switch it to selfie. I put the 10-second timer on.
So you're doing more of a timer? Because I know some people do like video. They'll just run a video.
They'll run it the whole time.
And then
time,
they'll just get a still shot out of the video.
No, I don't do that. I set up a timer. And when I do selfie, I can see it. And so I'm literally have the fish in the water, in the net, and I'm looking at the timer. And then, you know, 7 or 8 count, I lift up. It snaps right back in.
See?
Yeah.
He told me. I got him to tell me. Just had to call him on it. That's all.
And people ask, and it's not, you know, the key, whether where you're doing it yourself or someone else,
yeah,
you have to know how to hold trout,
right,
and even how trout react.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a certain way. You can't grab them. You can't pinch them.
Yeah, yeah, because then they're going to start.
They want to struggle with you.
Yeah.
And so there's just a way to,
caress,
you know, wet your hands, hold them in the water, and they just, you know, hold. You can hold their tail tighter, and they just, you know, they're fine. And you see the relaxation, and yeah, you're just cradling them, and they just lift up. And, you know, most people, you know, I mean, us in general as people, you know, we want to, like, force it and, you know, struggle it, and I got to...
Let me ask you, Chris, do you think, because it sounds like you're communicating with the fish when you're gentle with getting them to relax for the photo. Do you think your time working with the dogs helped you with that?
I think so.
Communicating with animals? And
I think so, because it was something that came really natural to me. And there's a lot of, if I'm going to brag about one thing, I definitely would brag about holding a fish. Not a lot of other things, you know. But yeah, there's, you know, it was very intuitive to me about how to do it. And
yeah,
there's cool, a weird connection with catch and release as well that is hard to explain, certainly to somebody that, you know, keeps fish. I love eating fish, but, you know, I catch and release. I mean, that's...
Yeah. And I'm like you. I love eating fish, but unless I'm up in the deep woods of Canada at my own,
yeah,
camp up there where we're going to everyone take home one or two brook trout and have a fish fry, I mean, we've got abundant brook trout up there, we're just throwing everything back,
yeah,
you know, catch and release. So, do you find that you have a nice connection with other animals besides the dogs and the
I mean,
fish?
You know, I don't like cats.
Okay. All right. Well, now we know that.
Uh-oh.
Is Bobby Joe a cat person? Or?
No.
No, good.
I'm going to get a bunch of Instagram hate now, yeah, for cats. I'm not mean to any animals. Dogs, when other people have dogs, I mean, I usually can connect with,
yeah,
with that dog. But
so tell me about this other kind of love affair you have in your life.
Oh, yes.
Bourbon.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, same thing. I mean, like I told you before, is I'm all in or... Or not, I can't do anything just part way.
Yeah.
I don't dabble in anything. Even by, like, grilling and barbecue, it's just, you know, something I wasn't good at, and then I want to figure it out. And
yeah,
so bourbon, it was the same thing. You know, it's like a lot of people, you know, you try something, you know, like Buffalo Trace, and it's easy, and it's a typical, you know, bourbon taste and flavor, and it's like, wow, this is good. And then you start seeing the differences in other bourbons, and, you know, next thing you know, you have 100 bottles on your shelf.
And you're posting videos on YouTube about hiding them from your wife.
Yes. Yeah. You haven't even seen that yet. A guy did a YouTube video. It's hilarious. How to hide bourbon from your wife.
I saw that on your channel. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And so you're actually even kind of branding your own version of a bourbon, or what did I see you do?
Yeah, so it started of, you know, like, so I've, you know, like everybody has like trout, you know, trout patterns are on everything. So I'm wearing my trout shoes, and because of really into bourbon, I'm like, you know, I want a sticker, and I think it'd be cool to have like a bourbon sticker, and the liquid is the, you know, the pattern. And when I was doing that, I was communicating with the distillery as well. So in the back of my mind, but there was details to kind of work through. Yes. So it's not something that, you know, I'm going to do as a business. It's not going to be really available, but it is. They sent me some samples.
Yeah.
Tried them. Picked the one I wanted.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a, you know, small batch, single barrel, and I'm having a label made, and it's going to be... buttery brown bourbon, just like my sticker, and it has some of that characteristics of buttery as well in the flavor. So it's going to have my custom label on it, and
cool.
I'm going to have yeah.
Well, I'm not going to let you get out of here because I know we had talked a little bit about Cortland, but I want to talk a little bit about Douglas because you're also a brand ambassador for Douglas, and they have incredible rods. I was able,
yes,
to fish them quite a bit over the past couple of years. I have several Douglas rods myself. What about the brand attract you to Douglas, and maybe just kind of give our listeners who may not be familiar with the Douglas rods some, you know, differences, you know, because it's not like an ad here. I mean, we all love gear as,
yeah,
as fly fishing listeners and fly fishermen, we love gear. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we show up at a show and they have rod A, rod B, rod C, rod D. I mean, we don't know the difference between A, B, and C, and D.
Right.
So what about the Douglas makes them a brand and sets them apart from other brands in your mind?
So there's a few things. I'm definitely attracted to companies that, you know, awesome product, but the people behind the product as well. And, you know, like I mentioned, I'm passionate about my work, fly fishing, and I like helping people.
Yeah.
And so I came across the rods and I was like, these are awesome rods.
Yeah.
But then I was able to meet, you know, the people behind the rods, the family, and that really matters to me, where I can go to fish an awesome rod and have these quality, great people behind it.
Yeah.
Is something I want to help as much as I can.
For
them.
Sure.
And so, yeah, so it's all I fish. So I slowly, you know, got rid of all my other rods.
Oh, you got rid of them?
I did.
You're
yeah.
not like you're going to have them and add to your
no,
collection.
I did at first.
Yeah.
And then I was just like,
I'm not using
I
these.
Don't like these other rods.
So what'd you do
you
with
know?
Them?
I sold them.
Nice.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's funny because people, you know, like for me, and that's a perfect example. It's like, okay, I love the rods, but I'm not going to get rid of these other rods I
yeah.
have, because these are good rods. And then I fish them more and I get more and I'm just like, I love the rods.
Right.
I can't be an ambassador or back a brand that I don't like.
Yeah.
And that was the beauty of it is
right.
I love the product.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the people. Why use these other rods?
Perfect. No, that's well said. That's well said. Chris, before we let you get out of here, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Enjoyed getting to know you a bit. How can people stay in touch with you? How can they connect with you? And what are some of your channels that we can follow?
Main one that I'm on is Instagram, Chris J. Hansen. Hansen is H-A-N-S-O-N. My film, The Day I Disremembered, is on YouTube. If you do a search for that, you can find it. You know, feel free to reach out. Anybody that's reached out to me on Instagram with questions, they know I answer every single one of them.
Nice. Thanks again for being on the podcast, Chris.
Thank you, Rob. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.